Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, Alt in Our Stars podcast. That is the name of the show. The name of me is Chris Payne. I cover rock and alternative music here at Billboard.com. Probably my favorite thing to do, you know, I like pretty much everything I do at Billboard, but my favorite thing to do is this podcast that you're listening to. And I was fortunate to have a really excellent guest on my podcast this week. His name is Butch Vig, and if you like any kind of rock music from the past 30 years, then you're a fan of Butch Vig. He produced Nirvana's Nevermind. He produced Smashing Pumpkins' Siamese Dream. He's produced Against Me. He's in the band Garbage, who we talk about the new music they have coming up. We talk about Foo Fighters' Sonic Highways. That's the Foo Fighters album recorded in 8 different cities in America with HBO documentary capturing all of it. So we talked about whether or not that will come back for round 2. It seems like the answer is yes. Nothing official has been announced yet, but he dropped some hints about what to expect from Foo Fighters coming up. I think there's going to be a second installment of Sonic Highways coming pretty soon. Talked about new Garbage music. I think you'll probably hear that sometime midway next year, maybe before that. So interesting things happening in the life right now of Butch Vig, and I'm really, really happy that he came by Billboard to chat. So here it is, Alt in Our Stars podcast with Butch Vig. Enjoy. I can breathe you in. Here with Butch Vig talking. I was going to say, there's 2 20th anniversaries going on right now that you are involved in some way. The Garbage anniversary and just the Foo Fighters of existing 20th anniversary.
Kind of crazy and really fun. I think also, you're right, I think the Foo's debut album came out the same year our debut album came out. I remember we played a bunch of festivals with the Foo Fighters back in 95 and 96, all kind of in the same circuit, you know, radio mm-hmm. festivals over here in the U.S. and then playing the big festivals over in Europe. But yeah, the tour has been great. We've done about 10 shows or so, and we're playing all the tracks from the first album as well as all the B-sides mm-hmm. that we recorded in 95 and 96, and some of those B-sides we never played before. So it was a bit of a train wreck in rehearsals trying to figure out how to play all the songs. So far, knock on wood, I think we've got them all figured out. The shows have been really good.
How do you think the audience reaction has been to the B-sides? How familiar do they seem?
It seems to me about maybe a third of the fans there are super hardcore, and they know all the words to the B-sides. In fact, you can see them singing them gleefully. I think they're totally thrilled that we're playing mm-hmm. these obscure tracks that we never attempted to play before. They just fly over the head of a lot of the audience because they've never heard some of the B-sides. But I think it's cool. I mean, we decide to only do about 30 shows. We're not going to turn this into a year-long tour. It's about 6 or 7 weeks, and so I think each show's kind of special. And so I think the fans who are there are pretty hardcore fans.
Yeah, and I feel like if you're one of those people who know, one of the few who knows all the words to the B-sides, you want to show off. You want to be like the one in the crowd who's like, yeah, I know the words to this.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. When we do the B-sides, they're singing it more hardcore than the rest of the songs.
Yeah.
And that's totally cool, man. It's fun for us to see that kind of reaction.
Yeah, and I guess from where you're perched, it might be easier or more hard to see from like from the drum kit how the crowd is.
Sometimes I can't see anything depending on the lights. If the lights are washing us from the front, all I can see is like the back of Shirley and see my drum kit. And other times when it's lit from the back, then I can see everybody. But it just depends on where it is in the song, you know, what song it is.
Yeah. And you said you're not making it a full-blown tour, but does Garbage have any plans for like recording a next album coming up?
We are 90% finished with a new album, which we're going to finish some bits and bobs recording in December, and then we're going to mix it in January, and fingers crossed it'll come out around May 1st, something okay. like that.
December sounds like a good time to just like be in the studio.
Yeah, I mean, I live in Los Angeles now, but it's kind of, things sort of start winding down at the end of the year. A lot of people start going on holidays or schools start shutting down or whatever, and we're going to probably work up until, you know, maybe a few days before the Christmas holidays, and hopefully we'll get all the recording done.
Yeah. Cool. And, like, how much have you shared so far? How much do you think the fans know about what to expect?
I don't think we've really posted any song snippets. We probably won't until we get closer to, you know, once the songs are mixed, we might put little sound bites out there. I have started saying, someone asked us the other day at one of the meet and greets before a show what their record sounded like. I said,
fans doing some homework.
Stoner goth rock. There's about six songs are very much like sort of classic Garbage, and about six or seven are kind of left field, more U-turns for us. But there's a couple of these long, like 6.5, 7 minute stoner goth rock jams. They're kind of heavy and dark, and one's almost sort of dubby. It almost sounds like it could be a track from the Clash of Sandinista if you took too many Quaaludes or something. It's that's kind of the feel on it. But it's been fun recording. We're psyched to get another album out.
Sounds like this fan was doing some reporting on the scene at the meet and greet. Broke some news.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. But you'll be hearing some snippets probably in the spring when we actually get some of the songs finished.
Cool. I'm thinking, like, what is it like for you now rolling out albums and like teasing things on the internet, thinking back to like when you started music, I guess like the early 80s, when I guess the rollout for the album was the record label or whoever sends out physical press releases, and like that's it. Like, it's changed a lot.
It's a completely different landscape out there. You know, when I first started making albums, you almost sort of had to figure out how to do that in a void. You know, I didn't even know what a recording studio was when I first started, you know, getting into bands. And then I wanted to become an engineer and a producer, and I never went to any formal recording school or anything. So I sort of had to figure it out on my own. I would go to the library and literally get these books on engineering and page through them and see if I could find something out. I would devour interviews by engineers and producers in magazines like Mix or whatever, trying to see if I could figure out, you know, what does a producer do? And these days, with the digital revolution, every young artist or older artist, anyone out there who wants to, has all these tools at their fingertips. You know, you can record a song in your basement on your laptop, and if it's good, you can post it and it could go viral and you could have a million people listening to it within 24 hours. That did not happen 20 years ago. And just the way bands can market themselves now, they can sort of take control of their, you know, of their own career. It's really hard to sell CDs these days, or, you know, MP3s or whatever, because music has, there's been a fundamental shift, and a whole generation of consumers have put music sort of at the bottom of the list. They still consume music all the time. Music is a bigger part of the fabric of the world we live in than it ever has been, but nobody wants to pay for it, and that's just sort of a given. So that's, I guess, one of the things that's empowering about the internet too. It's given, it's sort of leveled the playing field. It's taken the power away from the big major labels, but it's made it difficult for everyone, even young artists. I mean, it's hard to make a living touring, you know, for when the argument, well, you can just play live gigs and you'll do fine. It's hard. It's physically taxing and it's expensive to go out and do it, but it's still out there. So if you really want to do it, you can, you know, those tools are out there to get a record out and market yourself and do it yourself.
Yeah. Getting an HBO show is a good way of marketing.
Yeah, that's the best way. If you can get your own HBO show, I highly recommend it.
Don't turn that one down.
Yeah. You know, that's was working on Sonic Highways was an incredible experience for me, unlike any other album I've ever worked on. It's probably the most ambitious album that was recorded last year, if you think about it, because Dave Grohl and the Foos are one of the few bands that could actually pull off something like that, and it was really Dave's vision. You know, when he came in and told the management, told all of us, yeah, I want to write and record these songs in different cities, and we're going to make a documentary, and everybody was like, no, you're crazy. It's way too hard to do. It's just going to, it's insane. Dave's love for music and his sheer enthusiasm is really what made it all happen. We all just were like, okay, all the crew and management, everybody involved was like, okay, you're 100% into this. We're going to get 100% into it too. And we did.
Yeah. Because I was going to ask you, having so many collaborators, having so many other people to work with, if it made it in some ways easier or just definitely harder. But it seems like it made things definitely harder.
Well, it was really unique in the sense that normally when you make an album, you settle into a place and you get used to your environment, and then you sort of focus on the songs. But this, there were a lot of X factor variables, especially for Dave Grohl, who had the vision to go into each city and really dig deep into the musical history from his point of view, plus also from a viewer's point of view. Like, there were things I found out in all the shows that I had no idea, you know, I didn't know anything about, and Dave really had a true passion for it, but did his research. I think he did well over 100 interviews for the series. Like, every city, there were probably 15 or 20 interviews, just to really get into the nuts and bolts of the different artists that lived there or that were from there, that were from each city. So there's that whole aspect of it. Like, we're making a documentary, we're making a series, you know, a series of films about these cities. It's not just about the music. From my point of view, I needed to try and stay very focused about the music because sometimes there can be a lot of distractions. You know, some of the cities we went to, like Chicago, the first city where we recorded Something for Nothing, Steve Albini has a kick-ass amazing studio. So in some ways that was kind of easy to roll in there and set up and record. But some of the places, like in New Orleans, which is Preservation Jazz Hall, there's no studio there. It was just this funky room that's been there for 100 years. And then we set up a makeshift control room down the hallway, and you could just see people walking down Bourbon Street. They'd stick their heads in and go, hey, what y'all doing in that room in there? And
I know what Bourbon Street is like.
Yeah, it was crazy, and 24 hours a day too. But that was part of the experience. It was just part of it, kind of by the seat of our pants. Another X factor was that Dave really didn't finish any of the lyrics until the last day of each city we were in. He had an idea what he was going to do melodically, and I'm sure he had some bits and pieces of the lyrics, but the band and myself just worked on the songs together without any final vocals, really in some cases in pre-production with no vocals. And sometimes I would have to ask the band, like I'd ask Pat Smear or Chris Shiflett, they'd come up with these guitar parts, and Dave wasn't singing, and I'd say, is this guitar part going to work in this verse? And Dave would think, I could see him thinking and go, no, it's not going to work, it's going to conflict with the vocal. But he never sang me the vocal. And that was the first time I've ever made a record without sort of knowing what the song is going to sound like, you know. And so much of what a musical performance is, at least in rock and roll, centers around a vocal performance. And when you don't have that, you start making up in your head what you think it could be or it might be or what the vibe is going to be. We were all sort of on this journey in each city we went to see how the song was going to turn out each week, because Dave would, at the end of each week, the last day would come in, the night before, he would sit up and drink some wine in his hotel room and write down all the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And he borrowed and used references and little bits and pieces from all the interviews and the inspiration he had got from each city. And I don't really know any record that's been made that way ever. It's kind of crazy, but I think it kept all the songs exciting for all of us through the process. And it gave each song a bit of a vibe for each city. It really did. Like, Dave really kind of immersed himself in what he was doing, both with the band and also with the interviews and just being in that city. Mm-hmm. And I can hear some of that influence on the tracks, and I think that's one of the things that, that makes the album so special. Today and today, revolution on its way.
Working with so many like really famous seasoned like legit musicians, it makes me think, like, when you're an editor, when you're working with like writers who you kind of look up to, and it's like, oh shit, I have to edit this person and like tell them this looks better here. Were there any musicians who you collaborated with who it was like, huh, I'm gonna tell you to change this?
Well, every band is different and every song is different too. You never really know. I never really know what to expect. I mean, I've worked with artists who are very focused and they play me a song and it's pretty much done. And sometimes there's very little to do. Mm-hmm. And other times there's an idea of a song, but it's in a sort of a state of chaos and you have to work with them and work a lot on it to kind of pull out the best bits and get them to rewrite bits. And that's tricky because a lot of artists are very sensitive about what they're writing. In some cases, they don't really like to be told that the song needs some work. Mm-hmm. You know, I much prefer to work with bands that have a strong vision and they know kind of clearly what they want to do. You know, and it's my job to help them reach that vision. It's tougher, I think, for me and for everyone involved when, like I said, it's the you start a record and it's in a bit of a mess, you know. That's a trickier record sometimes to navigate.
Yeah, and like the Foos are so tight and seasoned with that now, and probably on top of that, from working with them with that and with Wasting Light, you probably just have, your guys are like this. I'm entangling my fingers like two for those listening. You guys are like, you know where you're gonna, what you two are gonna do when you're in the studio, probably.
Well, I mean, I'm lucky that I've known Dave Grohl for over 20 years. In fact, just a few years ago, we also celebrated the 20th anniversary of Nevermind, and that was a real kick for Dave and Chris and me to get together and talk about the making of the record and how it changed our lives quite profoundly. When we went in to do Wasting Light, Dave, I went out to his house in Encino and sat down, and he just started throwing me curveballs. I want to do the whole record on tape, and I want to do it all in my garage. And I'm like, okay. Tape, yeah, I used to know how to make records on tape. And and then when he said his garage, I was like, okay, well, let's go look at your garage. And we went down in his house and went down, opened the garage, he slid the door open. It's just a rectangular garage, not much bigger than the room that we're sitting in right now. And it sounded like a garage, just four perpendicular walls. It rang, had a certain ringy frequency to it. And then he set up a drum kit and he started playing. And I was like, damn, it sounds good in here. Okay. So it's like, okay, we figured out we'll run cables out the window up the side of the house and run them through the top and up, and there's a little room over the garage that was his like a study, and that's where we set up a makeshift control room. And it was cool. I mean, after working with Dave on Wasting Light, then I did Sound City, and that was a truly unique experience. I mean, that was kind of crazy, again, because I had no idea what was going to happen on a day-to-day basis. Dave had these collaborations with people coming into the studio, and he was also interviewing people about Sound City. So every day was a unique experience, and I had no idea what was going to happen when we walked in the studio, and that is really effing fun.
Yeah.
Because you don't know, and that's that process makes it really exciting to walk into a studio every single day.
Yeah. I'm interested, how has Dave in the studio, how has he changed and grown since like working on Nevermind? Because it's probably a hell of a lot.
Well, yeah, he's changed an immense amount in some ways, and he's also exactly the same in some ways. When I first met him with Nevermind, he brought this great energy and levity because he's so funny and just got a crazy sense of humor and charm. And the band needed that in some instances, especially as the record really took off, you know, just to try and keep them a bit grounded.
Mm.
He's an incredible drummer, but it turns out he's also an incredible guitarist.
Oh, really?
An incredible singer and a great songwriter, a great, great songwriter.
Mm.
And these things I didn't know. I got an inkling of, you know, when we did Nevermind. There was he wrote some B-sides, you know, when the first record came out. And sometimes he'd be sitting in the corner of the studio playing a guitar, but I had no idea that he's got killer chops on guitar too.
Mm.
Killer.
Yeah, because I'm thinking of all these qualities that he has now to coordinate and commission Sonic Highways, because so much of it it goes beyond being a front man, a band leader. It's almost like being a journalist kind of with the interviews and putting this together. So I guess there were small little inklings of that like leadership that you saw in him.
Yeah, it was his idea totally to shoot for the moon with Sonic Highways and go to all these different cities and really capture the essence of what the musical scene is like. He did it all, man. Every day, like we'd roll in the studio around 11 in the morning or noon. Mm-hmm. He'd already been up at like 8 o'clock doing like 3 or 4 hours of interviews. And sometimes in the middle of the afternoon, we'd be getting ready to track something. He goes, I got to leave at 3. I got to go interview Tony Joe White or whoever. And I'd look at his schedule every day and I don't know how he can do it sometimes. He's like the Energizer Buzz, you know, he's like the Energizer Bunny. He gets up really early and he just burns hard all day. Plus at night, he likes to hang out and have fun. I mean, he's a very gregarious personality. We'll be walking down the street after leaving the studio around midnight and people just walk by and go, hey, Dave, what's going on, man? He goes, hey, man, you want to go have a shot of Jägermeister? And pretty soon we just wander into a local bar, and pretty soon there's 10, 20, 50, 100 people. And then Dave's just, you know, out cruising around. We're all cruising around just having some fun. And we pretty much did that every night.
But Bourbon Street, tell me about you guys on Bourbon Street, Dave cruising.
Oh, there were some amazing moments there. I think the funnest part was one of the last days we were there, so many people had started to spread the word. The Foo Fighters are at Preservation Jazz Hall. So people were just hanging out on the street and walking by. And I think it was that Saturday night we were there. Sunday was the last day we were there. And the band decided to play in Preservation Jazz Hall. And it's not that big of a room. And they just threw open the windows and started playing, and within about 5 minutes, the police had to shut down the one block off Bourbon Street because there were probably 2,000 people trying to listen to the Foo Fighters. And they just set up a couple speakers outside, and they played, you know, an hour and a half show. And then Dave got in this he played with the Preservation Jazz Hall Band, and they the whole band sort of got into the New Orleans street dance, and they started doing the two-step going down the street with the horn swinging, and the whole crew of people just followed him. And we wandered about 4 or 5 blocks, and Ben, the guy from Preservation Jazz Hall, had set up a shrimp boil and all this Cajun food. It was so great, and we just wandered down, had some beers, and they threw up on this giant table about 20,000 shrimp that all these people went down. We had a crazy party, crazy street party, and so fun. That doesn't happen every day in a recording studio.
In fact,
that's the first time that ever happened to me.
So that sound was that number one, if you could rank out of the 8 cities in terms of partying, good times, was, I feel like, New York, maybe?
Oh, I don't even, I hadn't even rank them in terms of partying.
It's fun to
rank
parties.
I'll tell you where I think we actually partied the hardest was Chicago, because about three blocks from Albini's studio, there was this place called, I think it was Kuma's or Kuba's.
Oh, the metal-themed burger place.
Death Metal Burger Bar. Death Metal Burger Bar. And so we would, you know, work until 11 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock or something like that. And then Dave would go, let's go over and get a burger and a beer. And so we would all put our coats on. It was about 20 below the week we were there. It was freezing effing cold. We just pull our hats and stuff on, and then we'd walk in. By the time I would get there, my glasses would have frosted over and my mustache had frozen solid. But then we'd get there, and they're like, hey, man, you guys want some shots of Jägermeister? And they would just make all these burgers and sort of put them out family style, and we'd hang out there for an hour or two. And it's really fun. We pretty much went there every night after recording. It was a gas.
Do you remember what burgers you had? Because they're all named after metal bands.
The one that kind of freaked everybody out a little bit was the, I can't remember who it was named after, but it was like a bacon burger, and I think there was a pound of bacon on the burger. So this giant burger, and you on the bun they'd put like 16 strips of bacon, and so it was a little insane. So that way we would usually cut up into like eighths, and then everybody just have a tiny little bite, because otherwise you'd go, oh my God, I'll probably die if I even attempt to eat half of this.
Huh. Pig Destroyer. Maybe it was called Pig Destroyer.
Could have been. Yeah, you've been there, right? Yeah.
I've been there. I had the Mastodon burger both times. I was boring. I had the same thing twice.
Yeah, but it's darn tasty, right?
Yeah
it's and really... it's a cool hang there because they play death metal.
Yeah.
Really loud.
Yeah, it's a very, very sensory experience. It's overwhelming, but good.
I will say this. Every city had pretty much a completely different, unique vibe to it, and as it should be, right? Not so much from the studio setting, but more from just the personalities of the people who we met there, taking in the city, going out every night, even getting in the morning trying to find coffee and coming into the studio, and then seeing all the different people come through the studio, the different artists that Dave interviewed, and meeting a lot of them and talking to a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And each song on Sonic Highways, I think, is also completely unique sounding. You know, it sort of is its own beast in a way. I think that's what makes the album kind of really unique in a way. It's thematically linked together by going to the experience of each city having its own sort of vibe and sound that influenced each song in a certain way. And again, I don't really know anybody who's done an album like that, but I as I said earlier, I can hear maybe I'm obviously prejudiced because I went through that process, but I can sort of hear how each city sank its tentacles into each song, you know, and not just for me and for Dave, but for everybody in the Foos and everybody in the crew, James Brown, the engineer, and all the people, the film crew and sound crew and stuff that were there.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What was it like for you doing a lot of stuff on camera, being filmed a lot? Was that different?
I don't particularly like having cameras in my face all the time. You do kind of get used to it.
Mm-hmm.
I got used to it a little bit when we did Wasting Light. Every day you'd come in and I'd be talking to Dave, and right away they'd go, we got to get you wired up, and they put a little pack and a little mic on you, and then you just see cameras everywhere. The thing that freaked me out when we did Wasting Light was we had set up a little control room, and we had a little API board set up in the lounge above the studio, in the lounge above the garage, Dave's garage. There were a couple speakers in the board was there, and they had set this camera, remote camera, up, and it was about right here. So I'd be sitting at the API doing something like this, and we work on something, and Dave would maybe have just done a couple of vocal takes, and I was trying to listen to them, and everybody would leave the room, and I'd be sitting there, and then the camera would go bzzz, and it would freak me out because you would just forget it. I would go into this moment. I'm just concentrating 100% on the music. Mm. And then the camera would go zzz, and I would jump. It would startle me, even though, damn, I know that camera's there. And you forget it's recording everything, whether I'm picking my nose, you know, staring off into space blankly, or, you know, trying to think or focus. But you do start to get used to it.
Yeah.
You know? And then we did Sound City, and there were cameras there for that. And then, of course, there were cameras in every city we went to for Sonic Highways.
What about pre-working on Sonic Highway? Was there ever an album where there was like a similar amount of like attention, you know, recording in the studio, other outsiders there when you were working?
Well, when we did the pre-production, we did that all at 606 at their studio out in Northridge and in the Valley in Los Angeles. And that was pretty much just the band and me and, mm-hmm. you know, a couple of the of Lou, some with their local, the engineer who works there at the studio with him. But it's different when you go into a studio and there's a full camera crew, and plus Dave likes to invite his friends, so a lot of the people who he was interviewing just came and hung out at the studio. So there was a bit of a posse there.
Yeah.
And it takes a bit of getting used to that. I'm totally okay with that if the band is okay with it, you know. And I think the band finally, after doing Wasting Light and also just, you know, they're used to playing in front of big crowds, obviously, and they're used to having cameras around it. I think they're all pretty comfortable with it. The only one in the band who really doesn't like it is Taylor. He's not very fond of having a camera in his face and doing interviews. Although I find him to be I think he's very funny when he is interviewed, but he just doesn't like it very much. Mm-hmm. I think he's uncomfortable with it. But everybody kind of got used to it. But it's something I'm not used to. It's funny, back in the day, I never liked cameras in the studio. Like when I worked with, when I worked on Nevermind, I think there's maybe two or three photos from the session that someone had a camera and happened to click a photo. Or when I worked on Siamese Dream with the Pumpkins, there were no cameras in the studio. I always kind of felt like there's a doctor-patient confidentiality in what you do in the studio. No one needs to know about it except for you and the band. Now, of course, in this world we live in, it's about tweet everything. You know, everybody wants content for their website. It's just a world that's driven by everyone has access to everything. So it's completely different. And yeah, I'm cool with that. You just gotta get used to it.
Man, I'm thinking of like of what the Pumpkins must have been like in like 1993. If there was someone there recording all that and documenting that, that'd have been pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I wish I would have at least taken a few more photos, or, you know, had some shots of a band tracking or some film clips. But, you know, whatever. I didn't. I didn't like cameras around. Oh well.
Searching.
It's all up here in my head, Chris.
Yeah. Yeah, like footage of them searching for Jimmy, trying to find where he is.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other story. Yeah. I try to just stay focused on. I'm making music, you know, not the melodrama.
Ahead, I know Dave did an interview with, I think, NME, where he kind of hinted that there's going to be a second Sonic Highways. Do you know anything about what direction it might take going forward?
I think there is going to be a Sonic Highways 2, but it's still in discussions right now. I know Dave and HBO are both really want to do them, but it's going to be different. It won't be the same exact format as the last album. So, can't really talk about it because, honestly, I don't know a whole lot of the details yet either. I'm sure if it happens, it'll probably happen next summer. You know, they've been on tour all year, and I think they finish up at the end of November. So they'll probably take a little bit of a break. But Dave doesn't really like taking breaks much. I know he gets impatient. He's going to want to get into recording. So it wouldn't surprise me if it gets rolling sometime in the spring, or as I said, early summer.
Mm. How about this? Assuming you were producing it, where would you want to go in the world?
Oh, man, there's so many interesting approaches. You could sort of follow... You could look at some classic albums, or albums that I grew up listening to, or anyone, that Dave or anybody mm-hmm. grew up listening to. You know, where did Led Zeppelin record? Where did the Beatles record? Abbey Road a lot. When Paul McCartney came in to work on Sound City, we talked to him for a couple hours before we recorded. He was telling stories, so we just kept grilling him with questions and talked a lot about Band on the Run, where he went to Africa to record, and that was just a crazy experience for him. Kind of hard to believe he even did it back then. Mm. It wasn't necessarily the safest environment. You know, there was political turmoil there, and they just went, hey, let's go record a record, you know, and they did. It's a great record. But there's so many different interesting approaches you could take for a recording. You know, if you're going to travel around and do another Sonic Highways like that, but we'll wait and see. I'm sure Dave's. I'm sure he's going to get it figured out.
From what you've been telling me, I feel like when he first brings up ideas, he likes to shock you guys.
You know, I think I talked to Dave a lot when we started Wasting Light, and he kept saying, "What am I going to do? Just go into our studio 606 and make another album and put an album out." Mm. He goes, we've put out how many albums at that point? Seven or eight or nine albums. I don't know what they had done at the time. And I think for him and for the band, he just wants to have a different experience. And he really wanted to have that with Wasting Light. And making Wasting Light was a gas. And then when he did Sound City, that became a love letter to that studio. And I don't think he knew exactly how big it was going to grow when he came up with the idea to do that, and then it just took off and became this amazing film and documentary. And that, I think, is what gave him the idea to do Sonic Highways. You know, mm-hmm. he's just wants to have a truly unique experience when he makes a new album, and how he can experience that for himself and for the band, but also then how will that affect, you know, what listeners hear when they hear a Foo Fighters album.
Mm. And they've done so much already. There must be some element of, like, what can we do next? Like, they're the Foo Fighters. Like, they've done so much. It's like you want to keep pushing things forward.
Yeah, I mean, most artists that I know are always trying to sort of push forward, push themselves in some ways, yeah, you know? Great. And I think that's one of the things that makes a great artist really unique, is that they are going to take some risks and chances. And sometimes, you know, you take some chances and you might stumble a little bit, but I think you can learn from those experiences and to put obstacles in your way. Like some of the sessions that we did on Sonic Highways were hard, you know, and part of it because we weren't necessarily always in a cushy recording studio. And because the schedule got really crazy, and because we weren't sure exactly how the song was going to sound in its finished form. But I personally like those obstacles, and I know Dave and the band do too, because it keeps you on your toes, you know, keeps life interesting.
Yeah. When you were saying about, like, every band wanting to push forward, I kept thinking of when Metallica played Antarctica and became the first rock band to play Antarctica.
Yeah, it was pretty badass, you got to admit. I mean, no one's played Antarctica, at least as far as I know. They're the only rock band I know that's played there, right?
Yeah, no one before. Fall Out Boy tried to, and it didn't work out. And I think that there was a performance of, like, scientists who were stationed there at the base doing research. So the caveat was, like, the first popular artist or first rock band. But, yeah, just them before and since, just Metallica.
Yeah, who's going to be the first band to perform from outer space?
Hmm. Do you think Dave is working? I feel like Dave has probably already thought about that.
Sonic Highways is out of this world.
there's the tagline.
You know, if it was possible, it wouldn't surprise me that Dave would want to try and do something like that.
I mean, Dave's got some life left. NASA has advanced well over the years. It could happen.
You never know, right? Mm. I mean, this tour, the Foos have been on, they're playing incredible right now. They're, obviously you probably saw he broke his leg, severely broke his leg. In fact, the cast just came off a few weeks ago, and he's still rehabbing it. It was a really scary, dangerous fall he took, but he rose to the occasion. I don't know if you got a chance to see him in his throne, the Foo Fighters throne.
I've seen his throne.
It's pretty badass.
Mm-hmm. And he designed it too, right?
Yeah, he told me he was under medication, a lot of medication for his leg. He just sort of drew all these sketches out, and there it is.
Mm.
But I mean, a lot of bands wouldn't do that. They'd put the tour on hold and wait till they were 100% healthy and go back, and then, you know, either not play the shows or reschedule what they could. But I don't think he wanted to. The band also did not want to get deterred from that. I think they really wanted to go and play the shows for the tour for Sonic Highways.
Have you ever had to play through an injury or had to like rehab or anything serious that you had to like work through with drumming?
I've never had anything that serious as a broken leg, but yeah, over the course of, God, we've played over 1,000 shows in garbage, and I've gone on stage with 104 fever and you know, all sorts of weird illnesses. Garbage is opening for U2, and I didn't even know this. I got hepatitis A, and I thought it was the flu. I think I got it from eating oysters or some funky food somewhere. I thought I had the flu, and I kept playing shows thinking I'll feel better mm-hmm. better. And then I almost passed out at a show. We played the stadium or whatever, the arena in Chicago. And we flew on a plane the next day to Baltimore, and I passed out on the plane. And I woke up in a hospital in Baltimore, and they said, you've got hepatitis A, and we're putting you on IVs, and you're not going to be playing any shows for about 6 weeks. And I was bound and determined to not miss Madison Square Garden because I'd never played there before. Mm-hmm. A couple years earlier, Garbage is supposed to play with the Pumpkins, and that's when... sadly, Jonathan Melvoin, the keyboard player, OD'd on heroin, and they canceled that tour. They canceled part of the shows on that tour, and I was just bummed. I was like, I didn't want to miss that. So I played that show. I had lost about almost 20 pounds, and I really had no strength at all. Plus, I was getting these unbelievable migraines because of my body detoxing. Not to digress too much on this, but I played the show. I said, we got to play a really mellow set. And so I did. We did open for U2 at Madison Square Garden. Larry Mullen Jr., U2's drummer, came to me before and said, I'm going to stand behind you, sit behind you the whole show. If you fall, you can't make it or fall off or whatever, I'll just take over for you. And God bless him, he did. He stood there for 40 minutes behind me, and he had my back, man. So that was pretty cool. But after that, I went home for 6 weeks and recuperate him.
He was like your spotter. It's like if you're benching in the gym, but he did it for 40 minutes.
Yeah, man.
Ready to catch you.
I think a lot of bands, you know, if you can, there's sort of that show business thing, you know, if you can walk, you can play, you know, no matter how effed up you are, you know, if you can make it through the show, it's show business. You got to try and make it through the show.
Yeah, Bono just went through something like that after that cycling accident. He probably had to rehab so much.
Yeah, I mean, I know so many musicians who have walked on stage and had to do a 2-hour show. Dave was telling me, actually, they played some shows in Mexico, a football stadium, before we recorded Sonic Highways. And he got some nasty virus thing, like both ends burning, 103-degree fever, right, like hours before he went on stage. Mm-hmm. And it was a football stadium in front of 80,000 people. You can't go, I don't feel good. I don't think I'm going to play. So he went out and played. He said he thought he was going to die, but he played over a 2-hour show in front of 80,000 people. He was basically out of his mind with a fever and had been sick, and he still did it. You know, oh, that's rock and roll.
Yeah. So, mostly, like, is there anything else you wanted to touch on with Sonic Highways or anything else?
Man, I can't reiterate how truly unique the experience was. I just don't know any band that would even want to try and attempt to make a record like that. It was such a great, great experience. I think the album turned out great. I love the songs. I love the track from Seattle. That was really cool, going to Robert Lang's studio, and I love going to the city there. I love mm-hmm. Something for Nothing, the first track. I really think that Dave channeled some of the punk rock feel and some of the blues influence from Chicago crept into the track a little bit, and I think that I love that song. I think it's just an epic track. The funny thing is, that was in pre-production. Something for Nothing was the hardest song to rehearse because it was really long, and there's a lot of different parts to it. It starts out really just Dave and the guitar, and then it just builds and builds and builds, and there's these tempo changes and a lot of groove changes. And I kept thinking to myself when we went into Electrical Audio, Steve Albini's studio, that this is going to take a lot of work. In the back of my head, I thought, well, we're recording a tape. I can always record. We can record the front up to when it kicks into sort of the funky section, and then I can do a tape edit there. Then when it goes to the next section, I can just do tape edits. And I've done tape edits before, and we did a couple songs. There were some tape edits and a couple songs on Wasting Light. And so I was like, okay, cool. And I know that the band was – Taylor doesn't like being edited at all on drums. He's like, he just doesn't like it. He wants to just play it. And we got into Chicago the night before, and we set up, and the band ran through. We kept working on tones and stuff till around 11 o'clock at night or midnight or something like that. Then we went to the Death Metal Burger Bar and had beers and Jägermeister for a couple hours. So everybody was, well, you know, not even rested, but I think it sort of took your mind a little bit off recording tomorrow. And we got up the next morning. It was so cold, and there was, you know, couldn't even walk around. So we went right to the studio, and I thought, okay, let's just settle in. This is going to be a long day. And maybe around 12:30 or so, we said, okay, you guys ready? Tape's rolling. Mm-hmm. And they started playing the song. I was like, holy shit, this sounds so good. And they kept playing it, and they played it and played it and played it. And when they finished the song, I just sort of stopped and went, I think you nailed it on the first take. That it's I don't know how long the song is, 6.5 minutes. It's an epic number. Mm-hmm. And they friggin' nailed it in one take. And I was kind of blown away by that. There's also a section in the song when it goes the heavy guitar of do, and Taylor does a do. It's a really hard part to play on drums. Really, really difficult. And he friggin' nailed it and he must have laid up all night, Butch Vig is not going to edit the takes on this. I'm going to nail it in one take. Because he did, man. He played an incredible, incredible performance. The whole band did. And we spent a lot of time overdubbing guitars. And then Dave, you know, did his vocals at the end of the week. But I love Something from Nothing. I think that's it's one of the monster tracks on Sonic Highways.
Mm. And so these days, if someone nails it the first time, you won't just make them keep doing takes. If someone nails it, you'll let them get off with one take.
Yeah, I mean, I usually if it's a great take, yeah, you go, holy shit, you got it in one take.
Mm.
Well done.
You know? There's the motivation.
Yeah, I mean, they're such badass players. There were a couple takes on Wasting Light too. I think we got on the first take, but we didn't do a lot of takes. Even on the track that was probably the most difficult to record was the track in Seattle, because we set up to track it live and we spent all day getting sounds, and Taylor sat in there and we worked on the drum sounds, and the band came in and we started playing. And we actually did a couple takes, and then they came in and listened, and it sounded too much like a band playing in a studio, like a live. And we went back, and none of us could quite figure out. And then we listened to the demo we had done of it. And the demo that was the only song on Sonic Highways that was over, everything was overdubbed very distinctly, almost 70s style, like in a really dead environment. So every track was isolated. And we listened to it and went, well, that's how the demo has a cool sound, so we should, let's go do that. Let's approach the song with that similar attitude. And so we took Taylor's drums and we put him into a corner of the studio that was completely dead. And then we deadened him down more with tape and with some towels and things, very 70s style. And I think Dave had put down an acoustic guitar as a guide, as the main lead. And then we did something also I've never done before. We didn't like the way the cymbals were sounding, and we're like, well, maybe we could do Taylor could just do the drums and then go back and overdub the cymbals. You know, people have done that before. Dave said, why don't I play the cymbals live in the vocal booth with Taylor while he plays the drums live, and we'll sound like a drummer. The drums will be isolated. I was thinking, okay.
So
I don't really
sung, he would...
Not while he sang. This is just as we built the track. Okay. Dave just put down an acoustic guitar as the first thing. Then we put down the drums second. So Taylor played drums in the studio with a dead kit, but no cymbals, just playing the kick, snare, and toms. And Dave played the cymbals. And they played like one drummer. And I've never seen anybody do it. They did it in one take. So Dave's going, psh, and Taylor's going, boop, boom, you know, playing the drums. It has a very Fleetwood Mac sort of sound to it, that kind of 70s dead studio sound. But I was kind of blown away. I've never seen anybody do that. And it sounds amazing.
And just from complete ad-libbing and just like, oh, yeah, this makes sense. I'll go inside the booth.
Yeah, it was really, again, I think it was Dave's idea to do it. And we said, hey, you know what, I'll just play the cymbals in here live with Taylor while he does his part. You know, that we didn't overdub him separately. They played him live together. And also gives the drum sound a kind of a weird, unique sound. You know, if you record something in a room and you put an ambient mic up and there's any sort of live sound to it at all, an ambient mic will capture that. And your brain registers that. And when you record, when you deaden the drums down so you can't, your brain can't really tell what the space is, then you put the cymbals in another room and the drums start sounding quite unique sounding. They don't sound like you're staying in a room, and that can sort of mess with your psychoacoustic evaluation of where the track is coming from. And then we kept doing things in the track. We're adding a lot of reverb, a delay, and other things, and certain things were really dry, and so your brain gets this, the production of gets quite interesting sounding. A lot of that also then was sort of done in the mix, how you define where the space is that the song is in. But that was really that was also a first time for me. I had never done that before. That was cool.
Cool. So also, do you have any other projects coming up, any other artists you're working with, or is it just like...
I'm just in the garbage zone right now. We're trying to get the new record done. And as I said, hopefully in December, get all the recording done and mix it through January. So don't really have any projects scheduled yet in the spring. Keeping some after this tour and getting that done, I want to have some time just to figure out what's coming down the pipeline, so to speak. And we'll probably be doing some garbage shows at some point next year again too. Don't know when yet, but
yeah. So it seems like your projects are like life projects now, very big, time consuming things, as opposed to just like producing Against Me, producing Jimmy Eat World, like hopping from album to album like that.
Kind of has gotten that way, and even without me really even
just happened.
Realizing it. Yeah, I mean, I just, I spent a lot of time obviously with garbage, and sometimes the records can take a while to make, and then we'll go out and do some, you know, some live dates, and then working with the Foos, yeah, I've done, you know, besides Wasting Light, I did Sound City and then Sonic Highways, and those were all pretty epic undertakings. So. Every show I get bands that give me music. They don't give me CDs anymore. They give me the little, you know, here's a little memory stick, which is cool because it doesn't take up
nice
as much space.
You have a nice collection of flash drives now.
I have a lot of flash drives, yeah. But it's cool. I mean, I hear a lot of really interesting young new artists and bands out there, but I just haven't really even considered taking on anything new at the moment. Mm. So I'm pretty busy with the stuff I already have on my plate.
Is there just anything new just that you've heard that you really like that maybe someone passed along to you?
Nothing I can mention here.
Secret new bands.
No, not really. I'm trying to think what I've just been listening to on my phone or on my laptop. I love the new Beach House record.
Okay. Which, the new one?
The one that came out a month ago or a couple months ago.
Okay, because they just dropped another one last week. Surprise, kind of.
Oh, the one that came out like 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah, Beach House has been dropping a lot lately, so it's kind of hard to keep up with.
Yeah, yeah. I love some of the new Silver Sun Pickups tracks. We're friends with the band. I live in Silver Lake in Los Angeles, and all the band members kind of live right around that area.
They were on the podcast a couple months ago.
Yeah, I've loved them. Brian came in and sang on this track we did for Record Store Day, the garbage track called The Chemicals. And it was so fun working with him, man. He's really talented. And I love some of the tracks on their new record. There's mm-hmm. three or four killer songs on there.
Cool. So, yeah, is there anything else? This has been cool. A lot of fun.
No, I'm just... thanks for having me on here today. It's fun. It's fun just chatting about music.
I'm only happy when it rains. I'm only happy when it's complicated. And though I know you can't appreciate it, I'm only happy when it rains.
So that concludes another episode of the Alt in Our Stars. If you have any feedback about the podcast, positive, negative, anything at all, it would be great to hear from you. So chris.payne, that's chris.payne at billboard.com. Hit me up in email or hit on Twitter. It's at cpayne on a plane, cpayneonaplane. And if you want to give us a star rating on iTunes, that helps a lot. So all those things, all feedback-related things are super, super appreciated. And if you want to subscribe to the podcast, you can click the iTunes link towards the bottom of the story. If you're viewing it on billboard.com, that is. Anywhere else, just go into the podcasts in Apple and iTunes, search for the Alt in Our Stars. There you can also listen to archived episodes. We've had Bully on the show lately, Beach Slang, Magical Clouds, Albert Hammond Jr., Silver Sun Pickups, lots of fun stuff. So check that out there. A new podcast runs every Friday afternoon, new Alt in Our Stars, around 1 p.m. on billboard.com. So until next week, have a good weekend, everybody. Peace out.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.